The conference is now being recorded.
Well, thank you everyone for joining us today. We're very excited to get this group moving forward. This is Adam Lowe, the Executive Director of NACEP. And NACEP created this committee to facilitate communication and information sharing among the growing number of state leaders who are engaged with our work. And we really hope to create this group and this dialogue so that you can learn from each other and understand the context in which other states are operating. I wanted to introduce to you Brian Durham, who's the Senior Director of Academic Affairs and Career Technical Education at the Illinois Community College Board. Brian has graciously agreed to chair this committee. And at Brian's suggestion, as you can see on the agenda, we've decided to have each committee meeting highlight the policy environment in one or two states to help ensure that we each gain a deeper understanding of the successes and challenges our colleagues are facing. And as chair, he offered to go first as the guinea pig. So we're also pleased to be joined today by three national experts on the topic of dual enrollment state policy. Jennifer Duane-Zintz from Education and the Commission of the States has been doing research in this area for a number of years now. Jason Taylor and Vic Borden, who were commissioned by the Higher Learning Commission to do a report last year, have compiled them more recently, or not more recently, because Jennifer's just updated hers, but and additionally, another rich resource that can inform your work. And I wanted to give all of them a chance to give you a tour of their work so that you know how to access them and their resources. We will have some time for questions and discussion after each presentation. Given that the goal of this committee really is to serve as a forum for peer learning, we'll make sure that we reserve significant time for that discussion after each presentation. I will be muting the attendee lines during the presentation so that we don't hear all the background noise, but they'll be unmuted for the questions and answers and discussions, as well as for the final agenda item where we talk about the committee's future priorities. During those time periods, if you can mute your line on your phone to help reduce the audio clutter and feedback, we'd appreciate that since there are about 20 people on this call who will all have audio running at the same time. During the presentations, if you want to ask a question, you're welcome to use the messaging pane. On the bottom left side of your screen, you should see a little picture of what looks like a cartoon message box, and that should get you to the window where you can type in a message to the entire group. There's no need for you to ask for the slides from the presenter. We will make the slides and the audio available on the member sections of the NACEP website after today, and likewise we'll make it available to any non-members who are in on the call today. Since we are a small enough group, let's go ahead and get to know each other and just briefly introduce yourself. And I think what we should do is just go in alphabetical order as the listing on the participant screen. If you're on the webinar, you should be able to just click on the two-person icon on the bottom left. Brian, why don't you go first?
Well, thank you, Adam, and it's a pleasure to have an opportunity to talk with you all. As Adam said, I'm the Senior Director for Academic Affairs and Career and Technical Education at the Illinois Community College Board here in Illinois. And as you're introducing yourself, please do let us know what state you're from.
Hi there.
Hi,
this is Kim Mobley. I'm the Director of Communications and Member Services for NACEP, and I am based in North Carolina. Cynthia, down to you.
Cynthia Moten, Arkansas Department of Higher Education.
Hi, this is Dana Kelly with the Idaho State Board of Education.
This is Eric St. Clair. I'm with the Iowa Department of Education.
And Adam, this is Ione Deolis, and I'm having trouble signing in, so they're asking if you could drag me into the meeting from the contact list.
I will try to do that.
Okay.
Ione is with the Indiana State Transfer and Articulation Committee.
right. I'm the chair of the Indiana Transfer and Statewide Transfer and Articulation Committee, and I'm actually a professor at Ball State University, but I have been volunteering in that position with the commission now for probably 10 years.
Jill Thorne, you're next on the list.
And I just joined, so I don't know what you're doing. Sorry.
Just introducing ourselves briefly.
Oh, okay. Great. All right. I'm Jill Thorne from University of Connecticut. I'm the director of UConn Early College Experience, which is one of the largest and oldest concurrent enrollment programs in the country.
Hello, this is Jason Taylor. I'm a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign.
This is Jennifer Downey-Thorne. I'm a senior policy analyst at the Education Commission of the State.
This is Jill Kroll, Michigan Department of Education, Office of Career and Technical Education.
Judy Warman, University of Findlay in Ohio. We've just started a state group and even have a constitution and bylaws.
Lisa Reynolds, Oregon Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development.
Hi, this is Liz Valentine, Senior Associate with Missouri Department of Higher Education.
Good afternoon. This is Mark Stotler, Director of Academic Programming for the West Virginia Higher Education Policy Commission and also the Council for Community and Technical College Education.
Hi, this is Michelle Lee with the Colorado Department of Education in our Office of Postsecondary Readiness.
And good morning. This is Mike Hubert, Director of Guidance and Counseling in Secondary Education at the State Superintendent's Office in Olympia, Washington.
Hi, this is Mike Quillen, Kentucky Community and Technical College System.
Hi, this is Sandy G. for Gonzales, and I'm the president of NACEP, and I'm located in Schenectady, New York.
Hi, this is Victor Borden, formerly an associate vice president at IU, now just a professor of educational leadership and policy studies.
And this is Carla Wiscombe from Kansas Board of Regents.
Larry Shane, Oregon Dual Credit Oversight Committee.
Do we have anyone who hasn't introduced themselves yet? Well, welcome, and again, anyone who joins us late, we'll just have to see their name on the list. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Brian, who's going to talk about dual credit in Illinois.
All right. Thank you, Adam, and thank you to everyone for introducing themselves. I was doing my best to count there, and it sounds like we have about 15 states represented, so I think...
Your line is now muted.
Sorry about that. I seem to have muted Brian accidentally as well.
Your line is now unmuted.
Well, I said so many profound things during that short period of time I was muted. Anyway, I was saying that it looks like we have about 15 states represented, which I think is fantastic for an inaugural meeting. I'm very excited to chair the committee and to work with all of you to learn what you're doing, and I know we face a lot of challenges in Illinois, as we all do, and also great success in concurrent enrollment. I'm going to, as Adam had mentioned at the beginning, be the guinea pig or the first one out here around what's happening in Illinois, and I think we can work to figure out who's going to do this the next go-around or two as we go forward. What we're going to do is I'm going to go through some of the structure of concurrent enrollment in the state, and really how we refer to it as dual credit, and I know that varies across the country. I would entertain any questions that you have at the end of the presentation. And I also wanted to mention that I have Amanda Corso, who's our Director for Career and Technical Education and also listed as a contact on the presentation. She's in my office as well and has been a great help with this committee and the work that we've done with NACIP thus far. So with that, Adam, you want to go ahead and advance and I can work through these slides. In Illinois, we have as convoluted a system as I think any of the states when it comes to governance of the higher education exercise. We've got the Illinois Board of Higher Education, which governs all of higher ed. We've got the Illinois Community College Board, which I should say coordinates because we're both coordinating boards. The Illinois Community College Board is the coordinating board for 48 community colleges in the state, and under our auspices, we have administrative rules that lay out our requirements for dual credit. And then we've also had in the past few years a dual credit task force, and these pop up from time to time in the General Assembly to look at various aspects of dual credit. Out of the last one, we had the Dual Credit Quality Act, which basically applied our rules and the NACIP standards to dual credit across the system, and really was our first exposure to NACIP going back a number of years. And we'll get into this a little bit more. Adam, go ahead and advance. So here's the definition of dual credit in this state, and basically the focus for us is on it being that college-level course, and, of course, the concurrent earning of college credit and high school credit. And I'm fairly certain this is going to be, will meet the definition of everyone out there in the country. But what we particularly emphasize as we implement is that it's a college course, that academic control lies with the college, and that it's offered for high school credit. And so now in practice, it's often high schools approaching colleges to do this work, but we work hard to maintain that academic control at the post-secondary institution. Go ahead. Some of this I'm telling you, and you guys are probably going to know already, but the difference in Illinois around those definitions of dual credit versus dual enrollment. Dual credit is what we refer to in NACIP as concurrent enrollment, whereas dual enrollment is largely an exercise that is student-initiated, not administratively facilitated. Students do not need to initiate contact or petition for credit to do that, but it's a one-off. It's a student goes and enrolls in a college and gets some post-secondary credit, but it's not typically administrative arrangement, and that's really the definitional difference between the two in this state. And I know a lot of states use that term dual enrollment, and so I wanted to make sure that as I'm going through, I'm going to probably talk about dual credit even if I try to remember. So what we're talking about is the same thing as concurrent enrollment. Go ahead and advance from Malawi there, Adam. We have three models of dual credit in the state. Obviously, the first model is the one that NACIP spends its time and energy on, but there are two other models that we see quite a bit in Illinois where a college will send a college instructor out to a high school to teach. And then we have some models where we actually have high schools that will transport students to the college so they can take the course there. It varies pretty widely, but probably the main model is the Model A, and we have smaller pockets of the other models. Often it'll come down to if it's a rural area or if they just simply don't have the faculty qualifications, you'll see models B and C being implemented. Go ahead and advance. So the primary way that we govern dual credit in the state is through our administrative rules. And we cover each of these areas in those rules. And some of the hot points, of course, are probably the same things that are encountered across the country. Instructor qualifications, placement tests, qualifications of students, those sorts of things. But here's the list you can look at. And Adam, you can go in and advance from here. So currently we have a policy in the state that generally runs throughout all of these, which is college ready. Is college ready? We want the experience to look as much like college as is possible given the reality that much of this is taught at the high school. And so we want instructors to be selected, employed, and evaluated by the community college. That does not necessarily mean those instructors are paid by the community college, but they are selected by and meet the credentials of the college. And so they will bring them on as adjunct faculty in these arrangements, but typically they're not actually getting paid for that. It's an administrative way of doing it. So as you can see at the bottom there, high school instructors are often used as adjuncts, and what you'll see is high school instructors that are teaching dual credit will sometimes be coming to campus and doing adjunct work as well. So go in and advance. Students that are accepted for enrollment must meet all the college criteria, follow all college procedures for enrolling, have appropriate academic qualifications, etc. And the key here is that this is ordinarily restricted to students in the junior and senior year of high school. And that term, ordinarily restricted, has caused us much heartburn in Illinois because it gives our system an out, if you will, if necessary, if they want to enroll other students. And so we are actually working to revise our administrative rules currently so that instead of saying restricted to juniors and seniors, it would focus more on readiness for college-level work rather than that junior and senior restriction. So in other words, if students are ready, then they would be able to offer dual credit at any level in the high school. They have to follow college procedures. They have to have appropriate academic qualifications. In other words, they have to meet any prerequisites or they have to meet the placement test. They have to have a high level of motivation. If I could figure out how to measure that, then I would be doing well. But so obviously that's something that is on the colleges to look into as they do advising and work with these students. And so on. So the main piece is around that restriction of juniors and seniors and placement. College level is college level. They must meet those criteria. The Dual Credit Quality Act, which comes after the administrative rules and acknowledges and incorporates many of the standards from NASAP, was really developed from that Dual Credit Task Force because the community colleges had very, what we think is good regulations around dual credit, but universities and private institutions and proprietary and such didn't have any rules, didn't have any guiding principles legislation, if you will. And so the task force, in their report, suggested that these institutions be governed based on our rules and NASEP standards, and the Dual Credit Quality Act came out of that and impacts all universities and community colleges, one of the big, and all those privates and proprietaries. One of the changes out of that law, however, is that it allowed for institutions to adopt policies to protect academic standing of students. So if a student is put into a course and they get an F, we certainly didn't see that on the task force as a desirable outcome, and if a student was doing poorly, we put in provisions into this law to allow students to be taken out past the drop or the withdrawal date that was on campus so that they wouldn't end up with a negative mark on their transcript from doing dual credit. You can advance, Adam. Also, what we do in order to test the rules and to test the Dual Credit Quality Act is that we go out and do, we have a statutory requirement that we recognize colleges. And what that means is that if they pass our recognition process, they're eligible for state funding. And so we have dual credit, and these components are built into that recognition cycle. And this is an evaluation that assures that they're in compliance. They're evaluated on a number of different things. Dual credit is just a part of it. When we look at overall teacher qualifications or faculty qualifications, you know, we do, it really runs the gamut of everything that community colleges do. Facilities, funding, student services, articulation and transfer, but dual credit is a part of it. And you can see the list, I won't read to you, there are some of the things that we review when we do this evaluation. What we are looking for is systematic problems. You know, there are often one or two issues that will crop up that will not rise to that level. But if we see 20 faculty that are teaching courses that do not have the required credentials, then that would be an issue that we would bring up and have to work to correct with the college. I should say that, and I don't think it's incorporated here, but the qualifications to teach dual credit for transfer courses in this state is a master's degree and 18 graduate hours in discipline, and for career technical education, it is the appropriate credential and 2,000 hours of work experience. And those obviously vary based upon the career technical education field. You can advance from there. So talking a little bit about the data, as I look at the screen, that's a little hard to see, so I don't know how it is on your screen, but this is FY11 data that shows the top and the bottom, if you will, the lower numbers for serving dual credit students in the state. This is a couple of years old, so the information's a little dated. But you can see we have a pretty large concentration of dual credit in the southern part of the state, and a lot of that is driven by just the nature of those districts. And, of course, you have good people that are working hard to do it as well. The city of Chicago, if you look up in the top right corner there, does not have a lot of dual credit in FY 2011. There's a couple of reasons for that. But the important thing is that they are rapidly expanding that dual credit today. And we're seeing some real bumps in the numbers that they're doing. And they're looking at STEM early college models and doing a lot of different things to increase their dual credit availability. So FY14, this data may look a little bit different, but by and large, you can see that there's a wide disparity in dual credit delivery in Illinois. You can go ahead and advance. This chart shows you the enrollments by region. So the southern region, which is the most rural of our Illinois, has the highest enrollment in dual credit. And the northeast region, which would be that Chicago region and the suburbs, had the lowest. And again, these numbers are changing, but there's still a pretty wide range of dual credit across the state. Go ahead, Adam. The top 10 colleges provide 62%, and the bottom 37%. This, again, this is FY 2011 data. Go ahead. We have in this 2011 cohort, we have, you can see the number of enrollments there, 56% are transfer courses, 43 are career tech. As we get into the 2014 data, that starts to even out a little bit and gets more around a 50-50 split, but pretty close to that anyway. So you have a lot of enrollments in the transfer and CTE. Go ahead. Here are our top 10 enrollments. English Comp is, I would imagine, is common everywhere, being pretty high, but about 10,000 enrollments. And you get into kind of a mix of career and technical education and transfer disciplines as well. Psychology is high on the list, history, welding. So those are the top 10. Go ahead, Adam. So some of the directions that we're heading now, and I've already mentioned the administrative rule changes, but we're changing that rule around students, the junior and senior rule that I mentioned, when they can take dual credit. We also had a provision in there that was largely ignored in our system, but that limited dual credit to the first year of career and technical programs. We're eliminating that. And just generally trying to do things in our rules that clear the way for more dual credit opportunities. We also have worked, and particularly Amanda in my office has led a lot of this work, on dual credit workshops across the state that both lay out a lot of this same information that you're hearing, but also give an opportunity for our system to share best practices on a peer-to-peer basis. This year we released 20 dual credit grants, pretty small money grants, but have been well received by the system that are largely aimed at moving the ball forward a step, basically asking that they use the dollars to help deliver dual credit in a new location or in a new subject matter, or to work on alignment of curriculum to get them to that point, something to move the ball a little bit, to move the goalpost, if you will. And then we've worked with the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign to commission a dual credit study focused on pay models or financing in the state. One thing we don't know enough about in Illinois is how dual credit is paid for. And what we do know is that it is widely variable. Some students pay tuition, some don't. Some institutions pay tuition, others pay fees, some work it out between them. It's all over the place. So that's something we're trying to get a handle on in Illinois. And then, of course, in October, we'll be hosting the NACEP conference in Chicago. And so we want to welcome you all to that conference, I hope. And I know one of the topics later is about where we should hold a face-to-face convening. And that was one of the options listed. But either way, I know we'll see a lot of you at that conference. So with that said, I think that's about it. There's my email if you have any questions, or Amanda, who, as I said, is our dual credit contact here at the agency. You can email us with any questions. But with that said, I'd also entertain any questions about the presentation.
Great. Thank you, Brian. I'm going to go ahead and unmute the line so that people can go ahead and ask any questions they might have. You're also welcome to use the chat screen as well.
And we have Carla is typing a message.
This is Dana. Can you hear me now?
I can.
We can.
Okay, great. I've gotten halfway through a question before your line is unmuted came on, so I'm sorry about that. But thank you for that great presentation. I took lots of notes. And I will look into a few things here, but one of the questions that came to my mind was on your slide where you showed the top 10 courses that were being offered. You showed English composition was the top one, and for some reason in Idaho, that's the one where we get the biggest resistance from our institutions willing to offer that in the high school model. And I was wondering if you've ever met any resistance and how you've kind of gotten over that.
It varies pretty widely. I think that, Adam, there's music. Can you turn the music off?
Not mine. I will see if I can do it.
Oh, okay.
Your line is now muted.
trying to unmute Brian here for a second.
Your line is now unmuted.
Okay. So, Dana, again, I had a great answer to that while I was muted. you know, to be honest with you, that we do not deal with much of that. I think that institutions that have a good culture for dual credit are able to deal with some of it. But from the state office perspective, you know, if there is a push against dual credit on English Comp, there's a push against dual credit generally.
Okay.
You know, so either an institution is able to, there's kind of a couple of ways that institutions come down. They will be very transfer-oriented in their dual credit. They will be very career and technical education-oriented. Or they'll do both, or they won't do it at all. I mean, that's kind of the four ways it shakes out. But I think it ultimately comes down to what connections can be built between those high school faculty and college folks. I mean, as you know, so not much of an answer, but you know, it's one really that probably we could pose to our institutions to give you a better sense. Carla, your question about nurse's aide for dual credit, that is a college level course in Illinois, in various places, and so there are opportunities for dual credit there. Actually, it's a pretty good a gateway to get folks started on it. And as long as the issue of disparity with some students paying and some not, I won't say that we have plans to standardize it. I think really we just want to understand it right now. There are a lot of considerations. I mean, for one thing, in Illinois, high schools can claim average daily attendance or reimbursement for dual credit, and then colleges can also get reimbursement for dual credit. So in that sense, both institutions benefit, and that was a barrier we cleared several years ago. But it doesn't, you know, I don't think that it necessarily impacts whether students pay or don't pay. So we're just trying to get a handle on it before we move forward with any ideas around standardization or figuring any of that out. Mike, regarding your question about eligibility for funding, for many years we had several million dollars we used for dual credit, and you may know this, you may not, but Illinois is ranked 50th in the country as far as our budget issues and the problems that we've had. You may hear more about California, but we've been in just as bad a shape. So we lost that funding several years ago. And so we're trying now to do things like repurposing some money to do those dual credit enhancement grants, for example. It's not nearly the same amount of money, but it gives folks a little something to work with, our system out there. But there's currently no dedicated funding source for dual credit in Illinois.
I think in the interest of moving on and making sure that we have enough time, let's move on now to Jennifer Duaney-Zintz from Education Commission of the States, and hopefully we'll have some time at the end still. If you've got further questions for Brian or Amanda, the emails are up here as well, and perhaps we'll have some time either later in this call or in future calls. With that, I'm going to go ahead and mute all the lines, and Jennifer's, I'm fairly certain I'll be able to keep...
Your line is now muted.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for the time today to join you all and talk about the work that we're doing here. And, Adam, I'm not seeing the slides coming up on my screen. Are they showing live?
It should show your title screen right now.
I'm not seeing it. I do have all of my slides numbered here.
I've just tried advancing here. Does that show it now?
No, I'm just seeing the comments. Now I'm seeing it. Great.
Go back.
Okay.
It's there now.
So, yes, thank you. So this is just a little bit of context for anyone who's not familiar with Education Commission of the States. As you can see, we work across the states and across education's constituents. And I just want to add a little commercial here that while about half of my time is covered by a Gates grant on dual enrollment, the other 50% of my time is covered by state fees. So I want to thank all of you out there whose states are paying their state fees because it's helping keep the good work going here at ECS. Next slide. So just a quick overview of today's content. I'll briefly go over a database that was launched here in December, talk about some trends that we saw in 2013 as opposed to when the database was originally developed in 2008, and then speak for a few minutes on a brief that came out just earlier this month on model components of dual enrollment policy. So first of all, as I mentioned, in December of last year, ECS launched an update to its 2008 dual enrollment database, and this was truly a massive undertaking for a variety of reasons. One, as last speaker alluded to, the dual enrollment policies in many states can be a little convoluted. One state calls one thing dual credit, and another state calls another thing dual credit that's completely opposite. And quite frankly, on the number of policy issues that I've worked at ECS since the 1990s, dual enrollment is right up there among the most complicated ones that I've dealt with, just because many states do have, in fact, more than one program. Some policies in some states are vague as to which policy components apply to which programs. Sometimes the statutes and regs in the same state conflict with one another, or the Department of Education prefers to use one term, and the Department of Higher Ed uses a different term referring to the same program. In some instances, either statutes or regs are on the books, but they're not currently active or funded. So as a result of these multiple dual enrollment programs in many states and vague or conflicting policies, I was extremely thorough in conducting this update. I used a whole list of search terms in statutes and regs, comparing against an ongoing ECS policy tracking database. I also looked at policy documents that are separate from regulations in either a K-12 or higher ed governing board. And then I reached out to one or more state contacts in each state. And I want to thank Adam for sharing some names of folks in states, and I know some of the people who responded are on this very call. So thank you so much. Asking these folks to verify ECS's interpretation of policies in their state or make any changes if necessary. And so my hope is that ECS will be able to annually update this resource so we can continue to have a national perspective on dual enrollment policies and identify where states are making changes, likely to extend program access and quality, and help point states to others whose policies they can consider as they seek to improve their programs. And so the slide you see here, it allows you to reach the database. You can see on the right side of our homepage, which is www.ecs.org, you can select High School Policy Center from the Projects and Institutes drop down on the right. Next slide. So this will take you to this landing page, which is primarily resources developed from a substantial Gates grant ECS had several years ago. On the left-hand side, you'll see dual enrollment under high school topics. So when you click on dual enrollment, next slide, it'll take you to this page, which is the landing page for the database. And from this page, if you wanted to pull up all dual enrollment policies for a single state, you can pull up a map and select your state. So let's say we've pulled up this hypothetical map and we click on Kentucky. This is the view that would take you to, the 20 data points for Kentucky. And you can see where we've clarified which policy components apply to which programs if there are two or more dual enrollment opportunities within a given state. And then next slide, please. Going back to that main landing page for the database, you can see where you can view either all data points across all 50 states, or you can select a single data point to view policies on a single topic across the 50 states and DC. Next slide. So I could spend a great deal of time talking about all the trends that we saw over the last 5 years on dual enrollment policies, what was surprising or not so surprising, but I'm going to focus for now on these four: notification, quality, reporting, and evaluation. And I'm more than happy to take your questions on trends we're seeing on other data points, either during the Q&A after this presentation or if you want to contact me directly after the webinar. So notification, and by this we meant, is there a statewide policy, not a local district or institution policy, that requires all students and or their parents, not just those students who meet eligibility requirements, to be notified of the availability of dual enrollment programs? And it sounds quite simple and obvious that students can't participate in a program that they don't know about, But, and this is again another surprise, we didn't see any state policy activity on this issue over those 5 years. It was the same 20 states in 2008 and 2013 that had policies on the books requiring this type of notification. And as we saw with other policy issues, there was a great deal of variation across the states, with some states simply saying that students and parents needed to be notified, and other states being much more specific on the types of essential program information all students and parents needed to receive. And in this latter case, I hope that these would allow families in those states to make much better informed decisions on whether or not a student should participate. Next slide. So quality is another critical issue of dual enrollment programs are really to provide high school students with an authentic college experience, and post-secondary students aren't going to get nervous about awarding credit towards a student's general core or a student's major for a successfully completed dual enrollment course. And just as with the notification policies, policies on this issue fell across a wide spectrum. Some states simply said that the local agreement between a district and an institution needed to provide for program quality, while at the other end of the spectrum, we have some state policies that are extremely explicit, spelling out what K-12 and post-secondary partners needed to do to ensure that the course delivered at a high school looked exactly like the course if delivered to traditional post-secondary students on the post-secondary campus. And this slide by no means is exhausted, but it does give a sense of the diversity of approaches that states are taking. And some states simply had one or two approaches, some states had all the boxes on this list checked, and some states had other approaches as well. Next slide. And so the good news is that we saw a very encouraging trend in the state policies regarding course quality from 2008 to 2013, with 37 of the 47 states with dual enrollment policies on the books, including policies to ensure course quality. And you can see those 8 states listed below. Reporting is absolutely necessary if states are to evaluate which students are accessing dual enrollment programs and the success of those students both in completing dual enrollment courses and in entering post-secondary education, placing to credit-bearing coursework, persisting to degree completion, etc. And while we did see more states adding policies to require reporting, this was from 18 to 30 states, it did strike me as a little odd that in an era where states are publicly reporting on so many other indicators of student performance, we have either, however you want to slice it, 20 states, or you could say 17 of the states with dual enrollment policies on the books, having no requirement that K-12 or post-secondary partners publicly report any data on dual enrollment participation or outcomes. And as with other elements of dual enrollment policy, these requirements vary greatly, with some states simply requiring districts or institutions to report the number of students participating in dual enrollment or the courses being offered for dual enrollment, while other states require student data be disaggregated by student characteristics or information on who is teaching these courses, such as high school versus post-secondary instructors, costs associated with delivering the program, and how former program participants are doing once they enter post-secondary education. Next slide, please. So evaluation is really critical, and I feel that we're really doing a disservice to everyone in the system, students, parents, taxpayers, if we're not ensuring that students in dual enrollment programs are performing well once they finish high school and enter college, and that there aren't significant disparities in program outcomes from institution to institution or district to district. And I was really amazed when I saw that the number of states with evaluation elements built into their dual enrollment policies doubled from 2008 to 2013, from 13 to 26 states. So it's really encouraging that policymakers seem to get that evaluation is critical. And just as with the other policy elements we just spoke about, state policies are very divergent on their approaches to evaluation. Some leave it entirely to local K-12 and higher ed agreements to sort out, while other states are extremely specific in the data that state-level entities need to evaluate and direct entities to make recommendations for changes to state policy as they see fit. Next slide, please. So as I mentioned earlier this month, ECS issued a report that I hope will be really valuable as states seek to improve program quality and access, particularly for low-income and minority students who, as everyone on this call knows, are many states underrepresented in dual enrollment programs. This report is currently available from the homepage on ECS website on the upper left-hand corner under What's New. Next slide, please. So it's my hope that states will be able to cross-check their policies in the dual enrollment database against the model policy components and see where any policy gaps may lie that may be providing some unintentional barriers to program participation or quality. Next slide, please. So I'll provide a quick overview of these 13 model policy components and then highlight one component from each of the four buckets these policies fall into. The first six, as you can see, have to do with access, and I'll pause for a few seconds to allow you to read these. As you can see, incorporating these would make sure that state or local policies don't unintentionally shut out from dual enrollment students who could benefit and have the potential to succeed in their college-level course but might not otherwise participate if these policy components weren't in place. Next slide, please. So just to pull out the first of these six components, all eligible students are able to participate. And so what we meant by that was that a district must allow an otherwise eligible student to participate, and an eligible post-secondary institution, space permitting, must enroll an eligible student. In the database, this data point is called offering mandatory or voluntary, and the state got a yes for this. As you see in Oklahoma, it was clear that there were no barriers either from the district side or the post-secondary side. And we identified only 8 states that had this sort of policy in place, and I pulled out a nice example from Oklahoma. Next slide, please. So there are 2 components that fall under finance. And having these both in place ensure there are not barriers to program participation either from the student or parent side or from the perspective of the district or post-secondary institution. Next slide, please. And so I pulled out the 7th of these 13 model policy components, and this probably seems like an obvious one to everyone on this call. And I pulled an example from Georgia where what we'd like to see from more states with state entities covering tuition costs for students. So the next 4 policy components relate to what we were talking about earlier in terms of course quality, reporting, evaluation. And it's really essential for states to put these policies in place so that dual enrollment courses are truly providing students with exposure to college-level content and programs are monitored and evaluated to ensure broad student access to programs and that students are experiencing success both during and after program participation. Next slide, please. I had mentioned earlier that we saw a very encouraging trend from 2008 to 2013 with the number of states doubling over that period of time having explicit evaluation policies, and admittedly some of the states that got a yes for this policy component in our database were a little vague on the metrics for evaluation. North Carolina actually had more metrics than this, but I couldn't fit them all on one slide without people's eyes rolling back in their heads. You can see the full set of metrics in the ECS database, but it's great that North Carolina is including long-term metrics in terms of college enrollment and college persistence and completion rates, because this policy that you see from North Carolina was adopted just in 2011. Admittedly, it will be a little while before we can see what sort of results programs across the state are achieving. Next slide, please. Transferability. This last one is intended for states and students not to lose their investment. And again, programs aren't living up to their full potential if students end up retaking coursework they've already completed through dual enrollment because the course is only recognized as quote-unquote elective credits. We did identify 22 states in 2013 in which public post-secondary institutions are required to recognize dual credits. And our sort of filter for this goes one step beyond states treating dual enrollment credit in the same manner as they would other transfer credits. In terms of a student is not necessarily guaranteed that a specific dual enrollment course would be recognized for credit statewide. So just to clarify, some states got a yes for this transferability data point. If a set of statewide core transfer course exists and a dual enrollment course on that list would be recognized in the same manner by institutions across that state. Other states got a yes, these states like Florida and Louisiana, that have common course numbering systems and articulation agreements based on those systems. If they assigned course numbers for dual enrollment courses in the same manner as traditional post-secondary courses. And you can see Minnesota is one of the states that ensures transferability for NAESP-certified courses. Next slide. Thank you. So my last slide for today provides a quick overview of what you can expect to see from ECS on dual enrollment in the coming months. And again, thanks in large part to generous support from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. We'll have a short piece on key issues in incorporating CTE into dual enrollment programs that should be coming out in March. And we'll determine the other topics of the Gates-funded briefs as we monitor issues that arise in the states in the coming months. The State Data Elements Project is actually a partnership with students of Uri Treisman's. Some of you may be familiar with his amazing work at the University of Texas, Austin. And his policy students this semester are going to review SEAs and higher education governing entities for dual enrollment participation and outcomes data. And initially, we'd hoped for a 50-state collection, but we're now pulling back a bit to ensure the accuracy of our information rather than cover the waterfront and maybe not have it quite 100% accurate. But nonetheless, for the first time that I'm aware of, we'll have data across numerous states on whether enrollments are being reported by various student type characteristics and on course program success or any unique features that certain state policy reporting requirements may have. And as many of you know, the U.S. Department of Education has surveyed for this data, but the published data do not allow you to make state-by-state comparisons. So that concludes my formal presentation. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have about anything I've mentioned earlier or any of these products or services that are coming out in 2014. Thank you.
Your line is now unmuted.
Thank you, Jennifer. I've gone ahead and unmuted everyone's lines. And I understand that some of you may have been having difficulty seeing the slides. You may have accidentally gone to the Q&A section, so make sure that you've gone to the presentation tab on the link web app and bring that to the, I believe it's called the content stage, if that is something you see on your screen. Do we have questions for Jennifer?
I don't have a question, but I can just say that I was just thrilling to see, you know, the attention that's being paid to the dual enrollment, and I'm just really thrilled with the information that's been coming out.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to doing this work as we're moving forward in 2014. And any thoughts, any specific issues that any of you are dealing with in your state that ECS might be able to assist with or at least raise our attention to in terms of future work, I'd be more than happy to hear more about that.
Jennifer, I'm curious on the transferability domain that you looked at. Did you see much in the way of connections with things like a general education core or specific career and technical pathways? I know North Carolina has gone that route, and a couple other states have been looking at that.
Yeah, we did see a fair number of states that have a recognized core for transfer across the state that would include dual enrollment courses. The CTE, I don't remember in policy being spelled out differently. Maybe on the ground that's how it's playing out, but when I read the statutes and regs, I wasn't seeing separate provisions in general for CTE coursework.
Jennifer, this is Brian. I'm wondering, as you looked at things across the state, were you primarily looking at legislation and rule? And I say that because I think about the articulation and transfer question, and we don't have any law that says that they have to transfer, but it works. But they do feed into our statewide transfer articulation system. And so I just wonder if you were able to capture any of that sort of thing in your analysis?
Right. So, yeah, on the first cut, we just looked at statutes, regulations, and any sort of policy documents that either the state board or the higher education board may have adopted, but that wasn't incorporated into regulations, and then pushed these out to the 50 states. And I think, actually, Amanda replied to the Illinois, and she brought my attention to the Illinois Articulation Initiative, so that's reflected in the response for Illinois. And I have to put a little asterisk, so we did send it out to the 50 states, but in some cases we didn't get a response, and we didn't know if that meant that everything was accurate, and they didn't feel a need to respond, or if it just got missed. And I know in a few instances we got state responses after the database had already gone live, and so we're working now to update those. So.
Thank you.
Other questions before we move on? All right. Again, thank you very much, Jennifer. Next up, we have Victor Borden and Jason Taylor. Victor's at Indiana University, Jason at the University of Illinois. And they're going to talk about a state policy study that they conducted last year.
Thanks, Adam. Can you hear me?
Yes, indeed.
Okay. This is Victor Borden, and on this first slide you see the list of those of us who participated in this project, and I'm just going to briefly introduce it and let Jason do all the work, as he should, as a postdoctoral person. So in about late 2011, the Higher Learning Commission contacted me about this project they wanted to do, which had two features. One was they wanted to use this new design they'd come up with of engaging doctoral student interns from across the country, or across their region at least, and having them coached by someone to engage in a study. And the other feature was what they wanted studied was what they were pretty comfortable calling dual credit, and as we all know, the terms vary widely. So they did a national search or a regional search, and the three people you see aside from me on this list, Jason, who will speak soon, Eunkyung Park from Indiana University, and that's just coincidence that she was from the same university as me, and David Seiler were chosen to work on the project. At the time, all three of them were active doctoral students, and since that time, both Jason and Eunkyung have completed their degrees and are now pursuing, gone on to other pastors, although Jason's looks quite familiar to the earlier pastor. So we engaged in this study wherein the Higher Learning Commission had been noticing that some of their accrediting teams were coming in with issues about dual credit. Nothing particularly dramatic, but they were hearing it, the term being used, and some concerns, not necessarily anything really difficult concerns, but they were just hearing about it more, and they wanted to find out more what was happening with dual credit in relation to their focus on accreditation and quality control. So they engaged us to do this study, and we basically spent the next 6 months, especially from April 2012 till July 2012, talking with folks from all the state. I'm sure some of you were among that. I thought I recognized a name or two, although I did not talk to the folks from the states. Jason, Eunkyung, and David did. And as a separate component, I interviewed the representatives from the regional accrediting agencies to see how this was on their radar screens. And it appeared that HLC was the place where it was most showing up. The other ones mentioned that, of course, they've heard of it and they know what it's about, but that they were mostly looking at it as yet one more new way in which education was being delivered. Similar to distance education, contracted education, and other alternative mechanisms from the traditional ones they were used to seeing. So we ventured out, did the study, and I'll let Jason take over and tell you about what we found.
Okay, thanks, Vic. Can you hear me? Adam?
Yes, and others?
Okay, wonderful. Well, good afternoon, and thanks for that introduction, Vic, and I'll also echo his comments. It was about seeing some familiar names on the webinar, and thank you all for those who assisted us with data collection. So we needed, when we began the study, we needed to sort of organize our thoughts, and we conceptualized this study around these sort of dimensions of quality as we were doing this study for the Higher Learning Commission and other regional accrediting agencies, which are interested and engaged in issues of quality. We decided to frame this around quality. So we looked at quality as far as inputs, processes, and outputs. And inputs include things like student eligibility, faculty credentials, funding, curriculum standards. Processes are oversight, issues about oversight, faculty orientation and training, institutional review and monitoring, and other forms of state review and monitoring. And outputs are results of the dual credit, such as learning outcomes, transferability of courses, and program and course outcomes. So next slide. So we identified six general research questions to guide our inquiry, and generally they related to what types of courses can be offered, who's eligible and who's not eligible, what criteria apply to instructors who teach dual credit courses, what else does state policy say about quality, issues around funding and finance, and then a question about the enforcement of dual credit policies. So next slide. And so we're going to sort of skip the methodology because we don't have a lot of time here, but ours was somewhat similar to Jennifer's method in the sense that we were looking at formal written policies in legislation and code, in board guidelines and administrative rules. So we had a document analysis of state policies. We first looked at policies that were publicly available online. And then we also conducted a semi-structured interview with a state contact or two from each of the 50 states, or I think ultimately it was about 49 states. And then we went through a pretty thorough coding process where we tried to quantify to the extent that we could these policies, and what we ended up with was a measure of prescriptiveness and the way to think about it is the extent to which state policy sort of is prescriptive at the state or local level about these dimensions of dual credit policy. So I'm going to just highlight a few of our findings during this presentation related to student eligibility, quality, and funding. So first with student eligibility, once again, it sort of relates to which students are eligible to participate in dual credit. So the chart here that you're looking at, the dark blue, which is on the left side, that represents a statewide requirement. The navy blue represents a local requirement. The state policy says it, well, this is required, but it's really up to the local institution and high school to determine what the precise policy is. And the baby blue is what we labeled as encouragement, where state policy sort of encourages it, but doesn't necessarily require it. And then the white means that there's either state policy didn't mention it, or the policy was not very specific. So as you can see, really, we saw about 80% of state policies regulated eligibility of dual credit courses. And these include things such as students' class level. Brian mentioned Illinois' policy says juniors and seniors. That was very common. Standardized exams, placement or proficiency exams, and GPA requirements. And some states do have specific GPA requirements. We also noted that at least 20 state policies allow exemptions or waivers to dual credit eligibility, where often someone such as a chief academic officer at a college is responsible, is allowed to waive an eligibility requirement. Okay, next slide, please. So I want to we want to talk about this sort of other quality assurance, and what we did, we created these questions in our survey by really looking at some of NASEP's quality standards and regional accrediting quality standards, and these are other dimensions of quality that don't really fit into the instructor category or the student category. So several of these are sort of processes. But you'll see some of these include things such as course rigor provisions, partnership regulations, student support services, requirements that high school and college faculty interact, outcome monitoring, stakeholder surveys, classroom visitations. The most common at the top was for state policy to have a broad statement that said something like, dual credit courses must adhere to the same standards or level of rigor as similar courses taught to students who have already matriculated to college. Okay, next slide. Related to this is we looked specifically at accreditation and reporting, and so we found that about 8 states either require or encourage NASEP accreditation. And I think NASEP has documented this as well, and several states have modeled their state policies after NASEP. We didn't include that in here, but that is another, another observation that we had. We also looked at reporting requirements, and Jennifer spoke about this, and I think, we found a similar number of states with annual reporting requirements where state policy requires dual credit, data on dual credit are reported. I think this is, of considerable interest to the research community because it's really the extent to which, we have data that we can really better understand what's happening to dual credit programs and students and constituents. And I think one issue is that a lot of states don't, or they're either working towards longitudinal data systems or they don't yet have them. So dual credit crosses that secondary, post-secondary boundary. So, and I think that's a challenge may be why we don't see this in every state. Although we did find that several states have done some type of ad hoc reporting. So someone, for example, from the legislature said, hey, we want some data on this, or a report was requested and it was produced. So next slide. So the last finding that I'll highlight here is related to funding. And we looked at funding in a few different ways. First, is there any sort of overall funding that is allocated for dual credit, and we found that a lot of states do have that. We also found that about half of the states have their policy speaks to tuition and fee regulation, so it specifies what the tuition and fee regulation arrangement is, or at least specifies that that needs to be determined at the local level. As Brian mentioned, in Illinois, for example, the policy doesn't say what dual credit tuition and fee arrangement should be, so it's all sort of all over the map. And then at the bottom of this slide, you'll see whether state policy requires full, partial, or no high school ADA funding or college FTE funding, about 28 state policies allow high schools to count students, dual credit students for full ADA. Two states allow partial ADA. 22 states allow colleges to count for full FTE and 1 for partial. And we also found that a few states now, as states are moving towards performance-based funding, especially in the post-secondary education context, the FTE funding wasn't really relevant, so it's not applicable. All right, next slide. So I won't go through these since we're running low on time, but I think Jennifer spoke to a few of these, and if you read our report, we also framed our discussion around sort of what the common promises and pitfalls of dual credit are, what we see in the literature, what we hear advocates of dual credit talking about, and what we hear critics of dual credit talking about, and then we based our discussion in the report on how state policy addresses those. So we're happy to answer questions about these, but in the interest of time, I think we'll move on just to the next two slides to tell you where you can find this information. We do have a long report that is linked in the next slide for you, and what is included in that report is sort of a 40-page summary of our results, and that's the meat of the report. We also have very extensive appendices, like 400 pages worth, where it includes our questionnaire that we use, a short summary of each state. Then we have these extensive state profiles, and that's where you can find sort of how we conceptualize the state policies and the specific policy language from each state policy is in the profile. We also link to state policies, and of course links are changing all the time, so some of these might be outdated. We also have an annotated bibliography of literature on dual credit. So next slide. We recently learned, I think maybe two or three weeks ago, the Higher Learning Commission took this study and they issued some guidelines that will be in effective September 2014, and that link is on the bottom of this slide. And what this these guidelines do is they provide a framework really for institutions and peer reviewers as they are conducting their regular reviews of institutions for accreditation purposes. This is what they should think about when they are considering dual credit, and these are there are five areas, and I encourage you to go to that link to look at what the Higher Learning Commission is interested in. And the last thing I'll just mention is that I'm co-editing a volume of New Directions for Community Colleges, and we'll have a chapter in that volume that reviews this study a little bit more succinctly, and Adam and some other folks also have a chapter in that volume, which will be out in probably about this time next year. So I guess we'll end there and entertain any questions at this time.
Thank you very much, Jason and Victor. I am going to go ahead and unmute the lines now. So if you do have questions for them, now would be a good time to pipe up. We do have one question that's already come in by instant messenger. Carla Crowell has asked what type of documentation the HLC peer review teams will be looking for.
I'm not sure they specified what particular documentation, but I think the guidelines suggest what they may look for if dual credit comes up. And, you know, site review teams have so many different things to look at. They have not been instructed to look at dual credit specifically from what I understand. But being a person who's been on site visits, I know you just look for places where you need to probe further. So if you do need to probe into that area, it's these guidelines that will be what the folks look at. One thing, my colleagues here at IU, when they saw the guidelines, the only thing they kind of balked at was access to learning resources, because they've been spending so much time in the post-secondary institution creating peer mentoring and tutoring and advising services for students in gateway courses, that if they have to prove that they have the same resources for the students in high schools all over the state, they don't know what they'll do.
other questions for Jason? Well, I want to thank you both, and I would like to take, since we do still have 15 minutes left on the call, I do want to take a few minutes to talk about the future of this committee and hear some feedback from you and also share the results of the survey that many of you answered. So these are the sort of four questions that I'd like to at least touch on in the next few minutes. In the narrative response to these, sorry, let me get the slide advanced. Apologies. these questions were all posed to everyone who registered for this committee and those who attended the meeting in October. With regard to the first one, what are the issues we'd like this committee to explore? This was something where we saw a lot of similar comments on the narrative version of this question and some of the other questions in terms of what are the issues you're confronting in your state right now? And certainly, I think each of these topics could warrant a meeting like this, so the combination of presentations and discussions on the features of state policy on that topic, with perhaps two or three state examples. What I wanted to do is just get a quick read from those of you who are on the call right now in terms of are these ones that rose to the top indeed the ones that we should start with? And are there particular topics on here that you'd like to share some of the experience that your state has had with one of these issue areas?
Adam, I'll start. I think obviously program quality is very important, but from Illinois' perspective, I think we've got a lot going on to look at the quality of programs. And I think really figuring out that funding issue and how programs are funded and ultimately making a case for funding of dual credit is or concurrent enrollment is something that would be very high on our list in Illinois to work on. I think it's critical. I think it's varied. Certainly, I've mentioned that how varied it is here, and I expect that that holds true across the country. I think it's something that we could all use the information to push forward a collective agenda on.
This is Ione. I would agree with that, and I would add into that serving low-income students, because here in Indiana, if you are on free or reduced lunch, then you receive dual credit courses, but that becomes a funding mechanism problem, especially for those institutions that have programs in areas that have high rates of low-income students. So I would fully agree with that.
This is Mike Hubert from Washington State. I would concur with what the previous two individuals noted, but also I think that there are some special needs. We have a very significant geographical area of rural and isolated schools, and so access not just around low-income and underrepresented student populations, but those rural isolated populations as well. It poses some challenges.
Other issues that are showing up lower down the list that should be bumped up? All right. Well, let's move on to the next question then, which is, what should the goals, outcomes, and deliverables be for the committee in 2014? Someone who will remain nameless put in this very insightful comment, I thought, knowing that this is a busy group, I would caution against the scope of work that is too large. So with that in mind, some of these ideas popped up in multiple comments, and I've listed them out here. There's some people who seem to be tilting towards model or example policy documents or legislation, while others seem to be more interested in reports and papers. What's your reaction when you see these ideas that are out here?
This is Carla Crotel from Ohio, and I'm not sure I'm clear on my perception of this, but it seems as though the Educational Commission for the States and the Higher Learning Commission, Jobs for Our Future, and a number of other entities have been compiling reports of policy, best practice policy, and things like that. So I know that this stuff is constantly changing. I mean, Ohio is just about to introduce legislation to actually establish some level of policy about all of this. But is this something that would be perhaps duplicative of efforts by better qualified and better resourced entities that are already doing that kind of work?
I think regardless of the direction we go in with this, we'll certainly collaborate with our colleagues at Education Committee and on the states. And as you say, clearly they've already got a number of reports and publications in the works. Jennifer mentioned some upcoming ones that they've already received funding for. But I think if there's some areas that you see as priorities among this group, folks like the Education Commission of the States are very interested to serve the needs that are identified by policymakers working on the ground. And so we can.
And Adam, to add to that, and I appreciate those comments, and I think it's absolutely essential that we work with whatever groups are doing this kind of work, and our Education Commission of the States has really has a good framework there. But I think that, to consider that idea of being a busy group, I think if we could just identify one area and think a little bit outside of just providing models and more towards how can we build a case, if you will. And obviously I mentioned funding once, so I'll mention it again. Looking at how things are funded and making a case for better funding of dual credit coming from the folks that are doing it in the state, I think is a powerful supplement to the research and to the development of the models that we're seeing out there. I mean, so that would be my the area that I would advocate for.
This is Ione Viola again from Indiana, and I would agree with that. I think one of the problems we have when we go in front of the legislature to argue one way or the other is simply not having a lot of I'm looking at build a knowledge base. We don't have a lot of knowledge that backs us up in order to make our case strong enough for funding or for particular language over other language. So I think building a knowledge base and maybe even, I know reports are very time consuming, but white papers, sharing of ideas, that kind of thing, I think would be great.
And I would add to that even sample policies, because that's something that's pretty easy to pull together. You can just, some of what we're doing with highlighting individual states can help with that knowledge base as well. And that also gives us an opportunity to make some forward progress without having to do, a big study or, something that's going to detract from just the information sharing that I think the committee can do. And some of it will develop over time, of course.
And last time. All right, we'll take this feedback to the next slide. In terms of comments on what your first dialogue and information sharing. There seem to be fairly widespread agreement that this format is a useful one to the ability to meet more frequently. But in meeting occasionally in person, try and go a little more than you're able to do. Sharing resource documents, dialogue, and in terms of if people were interested in getting together in person, when would that occur? There did seem to be, there was only one or two people who said that really, you know, travel is just something they're unable to do and or don't have a desire to do. And so these were the results of when people would be interested or available to come together for a one-day convening. And really, there's not much divergence among the other national education policy meetings. The people have their ones that they prefer to go to, and those didn't all necessarily align across this whole group. We will certainly explore both the first
choice. Adam, you're kind of fading on us. I think what Adam's trying to say is it looks like we have a lot of preference for the top two. The NACEP National Conference in Chicago and the Washington Policy Seminar, and I think we'd have to do some more exploration on which way to go with that. I don't know. Adam, are you able to chime back in?
Yep. Can you hear me now?
Yep.
Okay. Sorry about that. Yes, no, I think either of these is a possibility. If there were some strong desire to make it happen on the short order and have it in May, then we can certainly work to put that together, and Chicago is a definite possibility. There's ample time to plan for that. Any comments on getting together in person? Things we've overlooked. Well, I'm guessing from the silence that because we've reached our 90 minutes, people are starting to drop off. So I want to thank you again all for coming today, and I wanted to specifically thank our presenters for sharing with us all the fantastic work that they've been doing and the very informative materials that they've put together. We will distribute out the slides from this to this group, as well as the audio track. So you're welcome to share it with some of your colleagues who maybe were unable to attend today. And we will certainly provide contact information so that you can reach out to any of the presenters.
And Adam, if I could add one thing, we appreciate everyone sitting through the presentations. I mean, three presentations is a lot. I think the one of the goals certainly of mine in taking on chairing the committee is to facilitate lots of discussion around the issues so we can build that knowledge base and figure out kind of the direction we want to go with those deliverables and really just have some robust conversation and problem solve a little bit. And so I think if we do future meetings that we'll want to keep that perspective in mind as well. And give more time for discussion and structure the discussion a little bit. I mean, you have to kind of get started somewhere, and I think all, certainly Education Commission and the HLC stuff lays a great foundation for a conversation, and like we've talked about, we want to give each state an opportunity to highlight what they're doing so we can learn from one another. So I think I'll leave it at that, but look forward to continuing.
Thanks again for coming today, and with that, well.
Thank you.